This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. This show is brought to you by Phraseology, an iPad app for writing. Phraseology is a simple plain text editing environment focused on making it enjoyable and productive to write on the iPad. For more information, there's a link in the show notes or on outofschool.net that you can follow for more information about that app. Good evening, Bradley. How are you?
Fantastic. How about yourself?
We're getting a bit of snow here. I hear you're getting some weather too.
They claim that's coming. We have already called off school for tomorrow, and we had a half day. As we record this, this is on Tuesday, and we have canceled school on Wednesday, and then we have a half day scheduled for Thursday that we're canceling, and then we start winter break. So I'm actually off until like the 18th or something like that.
Oh, can't complain about that.
No, neither can my wife, as we have two kids running around the house.
I'll get them in snowsuits and get them outside.
Yes.
That's the deal. Yeah, so anything going on? Not a whole lot of news, I don't suppose.
No, I feel like this is always like the kind of the dry part of the year. You know, where I'm kind of anxiously awaiting iOS 7.1. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, we hear that's coming in a few weeks. So that'll be interesting to see how big that is and what that brings changes. So that'll be good.
Yeah, I can't wait for that, to be honest. We're having a lot of issues with 7.04 at school.
Yeah, I keep hearing, you know, I know you tweeted about the AirPlay issues, and we've not seen that as much, but I've heard other people are having that. You know, that's just one of those things. As Apple pitches AirPlay as a non-consumer-grade technology, you know, as they talk about that in their pitches in the education world and the corporate world and boardrooms, that kind of feature just has to work. Yeah. Because if you can't trust it to work nearly 100% of the time, then it's just, you know, you're gonna lose people. So that's got to get fixed. The issue I'm actually having is with Mavericks Mail, and I tweeted about this yesterday that Apple has a support document that says if your iMac Mail stops receiving mail, to reboot mail periodically. And to me, we got to get that fixed. Like you know, had a situation where that actually caused some issues internally with headmaster getting an email that was time sensitive that he didn't get because he wasn't checking his phone. He was on his computer. And so literally now he is rebooting mail a couple of times a day. And that's, you know, it's embarrassing for me to tell him that. Yeah. But thankfully I've got Apple's support documents, so he knows I'm not just making stuff up, and I've sent that to him. But that's, to me, one of those things that just got to work.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about in this show is, you know, the kind of political capital that you have to put out for any technology solution you want to bring into a school. And I think, you know, whatever it is, whether it's Apple or whether it's something else, you know, it's very awkward and embarrassing for the people who kind of led that project, whatever the project was, when it stops working for some reason. And, you know, that's something that has to be considered over time as well.
Well, you know, we were talking before the show about, you know, software is expected to be updated, but it's very troublesome when you see regressions. You know, even any sort of vendor, whether it be your printer, your networking equipment, if you introduce you know, something new and it's worse than it was before software-wise, then that's very frustrating.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a victim of your own success as well, because, you know, if nobody used their iPads, nobody would care that it was broken. You know, but the fact is we've come to depend on them so much that if things break, there's a huge problem.
Yes, yes, yes. Very, very true.
Okay, so for those of you just joining us for this show for the first time possibly, I just want to lay out what we had planned to do. I'll refer you back to the whole of the last show where we go into this in a lot of detail, but this is the series that we're talking about. We're calling it sort of Deployment 2014, if you like. And the idea is that each week we're going to talk about one or two issues that you need to think about if you're planning to deploy a one-to-one or possibly a shared deployment sort of in the beginning of the next school session, you know, whether that's August or September where you live or wherever else that is. So each week we're going to talk about one or two topics that we think are important for you to consider as we go through the process of starting from being a sort of ordinary school that has some computers but not one-to-one or not necessarily particularly modern technology, and how to go from that into being possibly a one-to-one school, certainly a school that's a whole lot more up-to-date, with current trends in technology. So, Bradley, that's our plan. Are you ready to go for it?
Let's do it.
We got some enthusiastic feedback on Twitter about this. And I think one of the key things, if I can beg people who are listening to, send us more feedback. You know, if there's something that you want covered in the series that we don't cover, do let us know. The feedback form's on our website. And, you know, that's always very helpful to us to know what people want to hear about as well. So shall we get into it?
Let's do it.
Okay. The topic for tonight is titled Vision and Leadership. And I think one of the things, Bradley, is that this is the sort of sine qua non of iPad deployments, I think, is that if you don't have vision and leadership, your deployment's probably going to struggle quite a lot.
Yeah, we were talking, you know, a few minutes ago about when things go wrong, and if the people, you know, it's very embarrassing in some ways for the people that were the initiators and the integrators. And so if you structured your deployment around from kind of starting from the bottom up, and you've had people on the low end, I guess, of the totem pole pushing for that, and then when challenges arise, it can be difficult because the challenges will arise. There will be things that were unexpected. As much as you know, we want to prepare, things happen, things change, again, especially with software. And so you need a strong vision, especially at the top of your school, top of your organization, that when there are frustrations and challenges that can, because of where they are in the chain, can drive that forward and people will hang on.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I don't know if you've seen this, Bradley, but I've certainly seen it where one person in the school really wants to do a thing, but they don't necessarily have any power to make it happen whatsoever. So what they do is they kind of ride on their own enthusiasm and the force of their personality and things to try and push through some amount of change. And, you know, all credit to people who do achieve that, because, you know, it's more than I could probably do without any authority in the school. My hat is off to anybody who does go from being one of many classroom teachers to achieving any kind of school-wide change. It's a very impressive feat if anybody can do it. And if you do it, you should be looking for a promotion pretty quickly afterwards, I would say. But the point is that I have seen schools where senior management are not involved in any kind of change process, and that change process is agonizing to make it move forward even an inch at a time. And it's always much easier. And I think if you really read into what makes a school change work, it's the engagement of the leadership at the top that really makes a difference.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can have people that can basically bully to get their way somewhat. It kind of reminds me of the stories about wanting to put iTunes on Windows, and they basically had to badger Steve until he said, do whatever you guys want to do. And when you know, I think there's a key difference, and, you know, even if it's not your school leadership's idea to do something, there's a key difference in basically pestering them and bullying your way through to get your way and get change versus selling your vision to them.
Yes.
You know, it's what's that old saying? If you want people to build a ship, you don't gather people to, you know, get wood and get nails, that you give them a vision for the sea. And so you go in, when you're talking to your senior management, you're showing them a vision of the future, and so they get behind it, and then they're driving it.
Yeah, you've got to essentially sell it up there and then have them push it on from there, I suppose.
Yes.
I suppose one way I look at this is I tend to split off vision and leadership as two separate things. They're kind of said together quite often, you know, vision and leadership and all this kind of stuff. But I think if we can sort of categorize vision as the idea of what it is you want to achieve, and leadership as the process by which you achieve it, then I think we can start to break down a little bit of what needs to happen in any school to achieve some kind of large-scale change, such as a radical change in the culture of computer use in the school. So I want to look at vision first, and then we'll talk about leadership. Okay? So the vision, essentially, is the why rather than the how. And have you read a book? There's a book called something like Start With Why. If you go to any Apple event, they're always going on about this book by a guy called Simon Sinek. And it's all about, you know, the motivation behind doing certain things. To be honest, I've never read the book. But it's one that gets quoted all the time in terms of, you start with why do we want to do something, and then how are we going to do it? So
yeah, it's always at the top of my Amazon recommendations. I probably should just buy it and be done with it.
Yeah, at least I don't think it's got a colon in the title, so it's not one of those books, but, you know, it's one that's kind of on my perpetual maybe I'll read list, but not quite yet. But anyway, the point is, I'm going to ask the question, pose the question to you, the listener, and to you, Bradley, why would you want to change your computer deployment? Why not just stick with what's going on?
Well, yeah, and because I think that's the question you're going to get asked, especially if you're doing something from moving from maybe like a computer lab with HP desktops running Windows XP to a radical change to an iOS 1-to-1, or even a, you know, iOS cart-based system with maybe a Mac mobile lab. Like, you're going to get asked the questions like, why? Like, what are you doing? What's different? Why are we having to? Why are you raising this money? Why are we making these big changes? Because we got asked that. Because we did this very, very similar model, and even from people that are, you know, technical savvy folks and understand it, they want to hear your answers.
Yeah, because in some ways, what people are doing there is they're using that question to kind of press back on you and say, "Have you really thought this through?" There's a few situations where, you know, schools can be in lots of different places before they come to something like a one-to-one program or a radical shift in their platform choice. And I know that the situation we were in at Cedars was basically that we didn't have enough computers. We had essentially done the hard work of getting people to use the computer and be interested in having the computer in their classroom, and we just didn't have enough computers for all the demand that we'd sort of created for that. Other schools are in situations where they are, their IT provision is so clearly outdated that they just know they have to do something, but they don't necessarily know what they want to do. They're just aware that, you know, like you said, your HP desktop is running Windows XP. That just doesn't feel like modern anymore. You know, that went on for a long time, but it doesn't feel new anymore.
You really notice those, and I don't mean this is going to, this is more of a general statement than any one school that I would be talking about, but you go into their library, and it's, again, it's like these big HP black towers that are caked in dust that the students are using domain logins, but they don't want to create a domain, an Active Directory account for every student, so they have like one account for, you know, 100 students. I mean, that's what we're talking about. It just, it's basically, to me, using the computers like a Dewey Decimal System or something like that. It's like not taking advantage of anything modern. It's just kind of the status quo. And, it, you know, even looking back to, I've been in education since 2009. Even looking from then until now, things have drastically changed. So if you're still running on a program that your vision for it was cast in 2005, I mean, you think about all the devices that, you know, the iOS world, the Chromebook world, the Google-driven world didn't even exist yet in our industry. And technology is more than just about the media center lookup for books.
Yeah, very true. I mean, I think there was a time when, you know, in schools, the place where you put the computer was in the library, because that was an information device along with all the other information things that you had in the school were all in the library. And I think one of the key drivers of vision for a lot of schools might be to take that out of the library and put it into the classroom where kids are learning day by day. There's also other pressures that might come around. You know, there's one about just lack of internet access across the school. Again, Bradley, one of the things I want to be clear about here is that the stories that we're telling are kind of a mix of all the schools we've talked to. We're not necessarily calling out any individual school with our examples here. But, you know, schools where they don't have any Wi-Fi. It seems unusual to me that that's even possible anymore, but it certainly is absolutely the case that there's plenty of schools that don't have any Wi-Fi whatsoever in the building. It kind of makes me wonder, you know, how do the teachers actually be teachers without easy internet access around the school?
Well, but it happens. Even when they do have Wi-Fi, if it's, you know, a hodgepodge of Linksys wireless G access points that are all, you know, that aren't centrally managed, that then they keep the internet so locked down that you can barely look anything up. Yeah. And then the teachers end up, you know, you wonder in those situations, like, are some teachers so fed up with it that they're just tethering to their phone when they need to look something up or show a video from YouTube? Like, I bet that's happening in some schools.
I'm absolutely certain that's happening. And this is a story from an actual school, although I won't name the school, where a friend taught. And he discovered that a number of children in the school were clubbing together their pocket money to buy a MiFi 3G access point so that they could put their devices onto the quote-unquote real internet in order to get some stuff done in school. There were examples where, you know, the password to that MiFi was being resold to other students for a certain amount of money as well. So there's such an incredible pressure of, you know, like the way our world is today, it's almost inconceivable that you could be a part of it without regular and free access to the internet. Yet in schools, so often right now, that is actually the way the world is, that you don't have access to the internet at all. And when you do, it's certainly not either free or frequent or high performance access to the network as well. So that's another potential driver of change. Another vision is we just want to bring the world into the school. And for me, that's always been a big thing in my thinking, is I look at the world that our kids are coming from into the school. And that world is full of 3G connections, 4G connections, broadband, laptops, smartphones. It wasn't full of tablets in 2010, but it's certainly full of tablets now. And it just felt so strange to have them come into the school and then put in place rules that are even more draconian now than going on an airplane, where you have to take your technology, turn it all off, hand it in at the beginning of the day or the beginning of the period, and hand it back at the end. I don't know if you've ever seen that practice, Bradley, where kids have to put their mobile phones in a basket at the front of the classroom before the lesson starts.
Yeah, it just feels so... I mean, to me, that's... When kids say, when am I going to use this in life? Like, you know, we were talking earlier, you know, being able to look up information and to research things, that's life. Like, that's real life. To me, that's preparing kids for life. And so when you're asking them, okay, let's take away all of your technology, well, that's not real life, because technology is real life now. I mean, show me, I mean, even, you know, a quote-unquote blue-collar job where you're doing construction. Like, You use technology, you use cell phones, you can look at blueprints on an iPad. Like, you use technology in every industry. And to me, one of the most important life skills is not the ability to memorize information, but the ability to find answers to questions. No matter what industry you're in, that is important. And so why do we try to lock down the internet where they can't look up anything? When that's, again, that's not real life. Now, I understand the pressures of parents not wanting their kids to find inappropriate content in schools. Am I saying that we should leave Playboy.com unlocked at your school, on your school's network? Absolutely not. But we also have to remember that kids can turn off their Wi-Fi on their phones, get on 4G, and can go to Playboy.com on their phone and could play that, certainly. But I think that's where you deal with those situations with the students and you talk about what's appropriate. Just the way you wouldn't let them bring a Playboy magazine to school, you deal with that situation then. And I think you put in safeguards on your network, and you do your best to block the majority of the adult content you can. But I think you should plan for more open access and adjust on individual sites when necessary, instead of like trying to go, you know, to the extreme and frustrating teachers and frustrating students. I would think it would be a failure of your network if students want to bring MiFis in. Like, they should want to get on your network because it's fast and it's open.
Yeah, MiFi showing up in your school is a network smell. Something's wrong with your network at that point. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, lack of internet access is certainly something that, you know, the way you and I think about the way the world works. If I had to go to a job every day in a school where there was no internet access, I would probably think that maybe people don't need it that much for their job, right? Because in this kind of bubble of education, teachers don't have a lot of free access to the internet. Therefore, they're sort of used to living their lives without a lot of free access to the internet. Therefore, they don't necessarily think that free access to the internet is actually an important thing to have. And I think it's important for people who are, let's say, keen on the internet, or at least recognize its usefulness, to continually make that point that think about how the world is outside. Think about how the world is outside. And I'm not saying there aren't teachers who recognize that, you know, the difference between what happens in school and what happens out, and that are not frustrated with it. But I think that can be in a very important part of the vision, is you've got to just make school a bit more like the way the world is today. And the last thing, Bradley, I just wanted to mention was that another big driver that I sometimes see is that schools just now feel pressure to quote-unquote use tablets. You know, tablets in schools, or, you know, there's such kind of media interest around it, and, you know, other schools are doing it, so we've got to do it kind of thing. And I think that at some level, that's probably the worst of all possible visions to have, is that we want to use tablets because we want to use tablets. And it's going to be important to think through exactly what it is you want to do and why you want to do it, rather than just say, well, we want to use iPads because iPads are the thing. Even though, you know, a lot of schools are going iPad for perfectly good reasons, there's certainly some that aren't, and I think that's something that has to be sort of teased out as we go through this process as well. Is it just getting tablets for the sake of getting tablets? Probably in some cases, but I think, you know, if you're planning a deployment the way we're talking about planning a deployment, hopefully there are better reasons behind it than just I've got a pot of money, let's buy some iPads.
Well, and I see this a lot with schools that get grant money, because it's money that's essentially free. And so what they do, they get a $100,000 grant to update their infrastructure and to buy devices. And it's, okay, well, iPads are the rage, so let's get those. Don't have a real plan on how they're going to integrate them into the network, on how, you know, any sort of MDM. They just have a truck of money. They go to Apple. They spend it. And then they don't plan to replace it. You know, they just say, okay, we got these iPads. That's awesome. Well, 3 years from now, you know, think about if you bought iPads 3 years ago. What do those look like today? Well, you don't have any more grant money, and you've not changed your budget to begin budgeting for them. And so what do? So those devices just get old and outdated quickly. And then, again, that all goes back to vision of it being something from the top saying, okay, we've got this money. We're going to do these devices, and this is why we're doing them. And this is how you plan to replace them. Because to me, that is the one of the key things is in your vision is budgeting and planning to refresh your devices even the day you open your current ones.
Yeah, we could put that under the broad heading of sustainability in terms of the deployment. So yeah, you're right. The vision has to be clear. It has to be centered on educational goals as well. Now, I think one of the things I want to be clear about in that is that I don't believe that educational goals is the same thing as test scores. In fact, I would probably argue that they're probably the opposite, in fact. But I think that one of the things that we were clear about at Cedars was that we were not expecting to put 5%, 10% on our test scores. We were looking for a way to make school much more relevant and modern and related to the outside world. And I think one of the sort of fundamental problems that you run into over time is that that vision is actually pretty poorly aligned with increasing test scores. Because as we've said many times before, you know, how close are test scores to a real world measure, you know, of what we actually do with computers from day to day?
Yeah, and I think I agree with you that test scores obviously are a goal. But if you have terrible teachers and you have parents that aren't interested in their students' growth, buying 1,000 iPads is not fixing that. That's a piece of the puzzle. And obviously, it's always your goal is to improve test scores and do better in every aspect of your school. Mm-hmm. But it can't be the only goal. And as you said, is that really the best measure of the learning process?
Yeah. What are the instruments that you're using measuring is a key thing. So if I bring in iPads and iMovie and iPhoto and suddenly we're making a whole bunch of great videos and we're using photography, we're telling stories visually, and then all of our tests are still essays. Is that really a fair measurement of what we're doing in the classroom anymore? Probably not. So that's part of the context of the world that you work in, is whether or not what you do with the technology that you bring in actually can be measured by the measurement infrastructure that you already have. And some of that can be changed. Maybe you can change your assessments, maybe you can't. And I think one of the things that we're coming up to as quite a mature iPad deployment is that some of those things can't be changed. Right? We don't have any power to change the way that, you know, English is going to be assessed at fifth year. We don't have any power to change the way that computer science is going to be assessed. And some of those things, you have to be aware that some walls are movable and some walls are structural, and you don't get to knock down the structural walls until you've built something else in its place. And sometimes you're not the person to build that wall.
Yeah, it's and I think that's important for the people, maybe your IT staff or your technology coordinators, not to get frustrated there, that you're not going to come in day one and change everything, and people be like singing hallelujah when you walk in the door. Like, there are going to be days where it's frustrating, mm-hmm. and days where people question it, and days where it's not perfect, but just keep plugging forward.
And a key part of the vision, Bradley, is also time scale. Like, how long is it going to take for us to achieve this? And I think the schools where I've seen a lot of resentment build up and pressure and resistance have been schools where the timetable has been incredibly short and has been, you know, rammed through. And often, like you said, that's rammed through on the basis of some kind of funding deadline or something like that. Schools where senior leaders have openly acknowledged that we have got 3 years to plan this or 3 years to get good at this, those schools, I think, actually improve more quickly than you would expect, certainly more quickly than they plan for, and at a more sustainable and, you know, embeddable way than schools that just try and change everything on day one. You're absolutely right on that.
We overhauled our curriculum a few years ago, and we moved to this program called Foundations and Frameworks, and it really is a driving force for the majority of our subjects. And it's still a work in progress because we have new teachers that come on board that have to get up to speed with it. Mm-hmm. We have some teachers moving from our K-3 program to our upper grades next year. And so they're having to go through the training. And new situations arise every year. And so we don't expect our curriculum to be perfect on day one when it's something that's brand new, never been done before at our school. And so why would we expect technology to be the same way? I mean, our teachers are better with technology this year than they were in 2010. And it's just we continue to learn, and you continually, refine what you do.
Yeah, that's true. And I think also that, what was I going to say there? In terms of the time given for it, I want to pull together the idea that lots of the aspects that we're going to talk about in this series all interplay together to produce certain effects. And one of the things about timescale is that if you just go out and do a kind of one-time magic pot of money purchase, that's something that, you know, teachers could actually sort of resist until the devices are obsolete and then they just go back to the way they were going. Whereas a model that has sustainability built into it, whether that be through leasing or parent contribution or something like that, if teachers know that this is going to be around for 3 years in the first instance, and then another 3 years, and then another 3 years, and it's just a rolling cycle of improvements all the time, they know that it's not going away. Therefore, they have a sense that they have to get on board somehow with this at some point. Now, maybe they don't have to get on board on the first day. That's possible. Certainly in a big school, changing the culture is going to take a lot longer, so you have to be aware of that. But at the same time, if the program is going to be sustained over the long period, things like leasing contracts are a really strong indicator to staff that senior management's committed, the whole school's committed, and this is not going to go away. Because staff come and go, leaders come and go, but contracts stay forever, right? That's a really important thing to think about.
Yeah, because I get that question often. It's like, when are we due for new computers, especially as we get a few years into the lease? And I could tell teachers today, we will get new computers in basically March. You know, March of 2014 will be 1 year into our lease. So March of 2016, we will get new computers. Mm-hmm. And we can say that today. And, you know, so it's, yeah, no, I agree. You know, it's the same thing with our curriculum, that it's not a 3 year pilot. Like, this is what we're committed to. So mm-hmm. you either get on board or you get out.
Yep. And I think one of the things about having a defined cycle and sustainable cycle is also that when things are feeling very tired and old and broken, what you can say, like when we had iPad 1 the spring of 2013, we're still using iPad 1, I could say to people, look, we've only got another 6 weeks, 8 weeks with this device, then it's on to iPad 4. So hang in there, we're going to get there. Whereas if it was kind of like, well, I've got these iPad 1s, I don't know if we're ever going to get new ones, maybe we'll just be like this forever, you know, people would have started cracking up at that pretty quickly. So yeah, that's all of these things play together. And that's, I think, one of the threads that's going to continue through this series, is all of these things play off each other to produce success. There's no one thing I can say to you, if you just do this, your iPad deployment is just going to go gangbusters. There's lots and lots of different pieces that you have to put in place and have to have an answer for, or possibly, you know, there's one answer that's better than others, but in many cases the answer will be contextual. But you have to have an answer for these questions as well.
Let's take a moment and thank our first sponsor for the week. It's Phraseology. It's an iPad app for writing. Phraseology is a simple, plain text editing environment focused on making it enjoyable and productive to write on the iPad. But also support writing with tools to improve word selection and to better understand and structure your text. Whether you are a professional writer, a casual blogger, a teacher, a student, Phraseology is a great tool to help you enjoy writing and to get better at it. Phraseology offers unique tools to arrange paragraphs and sentences via a drag-and-drop method, colorize parts of speech, and it calculates common readability scores and statistics about your writing. Phraseology also breaks down all root words used in your text and makes it easy to identify common writing problems like repetition and excessive use of adverbs. And it's got iCloud built in. It also has a Dropbox-based version control system. It's easy to email and print and share documents. It calculates Fleisch-Kincaid readability and grade level, Gunning fog, and smog indexes. The syntax highlighting also looks for parts of speech. Now, Phraseology is from one of the best iOS developers on the market. The company is Agile Tortoise. They also make the great Drafts app, which really powers a lot of the iOS automation that goes on today. So we'll talk more about some of those apps in a few weeks. But again, Phraseology comes from a top-notch developer. So if you want to learn more about that, go to outofschool.net, click on the link, and I'll take you to their website. It's important that you click on the link because that lets the guys at Agile Tortoise know that you came from our show. So again, thanks for Phraseology for sponsoring Out of School this week.
Always good when people who really know what they're doing building iOS stuff want to build for education. I really appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, because you don't want to have like the second-tier people. And I think that comes with a lot of the application model being so great now because developers know that people are buying apps in bulk and there's only one store to buy them from.
Yep. Yeah, no, that should give people a lot of confidence that they can make some money in this business. For sure. Okay, so let's move on to the next thing, Bradley, which we talked about vision. You know, what is your vision? Why do you want to change your computer program? What is it you want to get out of this? And how are you going to measure it as well? The next question is leadership, right? So vision and then leadership. How are you going to lead people through the transition that you want to achieve? And I was recently at a leadership training event in Scotland, and it was very interesting because one of the models that was presented to us as, you know, potential leaders of the future is whenever you try and bring in change, the trainer was actually talking about there's a model called the Kubler-Ross model of the stages of grief, and people know this casually, but that's the name of it. And there's those steps that are, everybody knows, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance of, you know, the inevitability of death or the fact of death or something like that. And this person was applying this idea to the notion of change in school as well, which I thought was a very interesting way to put it.
No, yeah, that is interesting.
So you might want to think about this, you know, if we take those classical steps of what you might see from staff or colleagues as you try and bring in change, you know, you may first see denial. Okay, there's no way this iPad thing is going to work. That'll never work here is a phrase that just trips off the tongue of too many teachers in the world. And then anger, right? You know, there's too much work to be done. This is a waste of effort. It's a waste of time. We could be spending this time doing something else. I don't want to do this. And then you get to bargaining, you know, as you keep pushing your vision, keep messaging your vision. The bargaining might look something like, well, I'll use it for taking pictures maybe, but I'm not using it for my core teaching, absolutely not. And then as time goes on, you may end up in a little bit of depression, you know, once you've kind of got over the worst of it. But, you know, there is work to be done. I mean, let's not kid on, Bradley. Making a big change like this is work to be done. So you may find that people end up in this kind of trough of depression where they feel like they know what they've got to do, but it looks like a lot of work now. So they're kind of like, oh, this is just taking too much work, too much time. You know, and then finally, you will, eventually get to the point of acceptance where, you know, let's just get on with the teaching again. And I think you've got to push through that. And some bigger schools will obviously take longer to push through that. Smaller schools can probably push through it a little more quickly. But it's going to take time. And you've got to, as a leader, you've got to give it time as well.
No, that's 100% true, because I think we can sometimes overestimate what we can do day one of school starting with a new program. That's going to revolutionize everything day one.
Yeah.
And I think it's important. You need to look at it over a 3 to 5 year lifespan. Not necessarily with your devices, but just from the program in general, and say, what do we want to look like in 5 years from now? Because like everything we do, it takes that long. Whether it's something with your curriculum, if you're, you know, putting in a new method for soccer training, well, does that really, like, you do it one practice and then you win all the games? No. I guess for you, it would be football. I guess for
the, absolutely, you know, people, the game you play with your feet, yes.
Exactly. Best, yeah, American football or everywhere else football. That, you know, when I was in high school, I played baseball, and I would make modifications to the way I would hit. Well, it took an entire season sometimes to see that become muscle memory and to see that become automatic and just be the way things are. And so that's the way it is with technology. Yeah, your teachers come in day one, they got some new stuff, that's awesome. Your students have new devices, that's awesome. But where you really see that is when, you know, the people who were in 8th grade when it started, when they're in 11th grade and 12th grade, and all this stuff is just automatic. And it's kind of crazy to me to think back to, like, when we first started with Google Apps, and people were like, okay, I want to try Google Docs, and let's see how this works. And then, like, now, a couple of years later, a lot of our faculties, it's just, they don't even use Word anymore. Everything is in Google Drive. And they're, you know, everything is shared with their cohorts on their team. That's just the world they live in. They're editing those documents on their iPhone or their iPad. And it's just, it's gone from, in a couple of years, from being something new to being automatic, and just, it's just the way things always were.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting, because the other thing you've got to be aware of as a leader is you've got to be aware of the kind of second order effects of some of this stuff. And I wish I had it here, but there's a great quote in one of Seymour Papert's books about the second order effects of technology in the classroom. And it's not just that you use technology, but it's what you can then go on and do with that technology in place. And maybe I'll try and find that quote. It's on a paper book, so I can't even look it up on my iPad just now, but I'll maybe find that quote for the next show. But the thing about that is that, you know, after a few years, I mean, I have a funny situation in my school, because I teach kids who are, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. I work at that upper end of the education system. And since we started, I've been teaching people who have sort of been under my supervision as we've gone through that transition. So they've been sort of users of iPad, but they've not been... They remember a time before it, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And when I'm looking at the kids who are about to come to me now, these are kids who are, we might adopt that terrible phrase, iPad natives. And they're looking at a different world. And I'm starting to see this from the younger classes that I'm teaching now, that things like, you know, I keep going back to this one because it's kind of on my mind at the moment. In assessment, it's almost like I can't persuade them that they can't talk to each other, that they can't collaborate on something, because it's so kind of built into that mental muscle memory, like you mentioned, Bradley, that's what you do, is you work together, you share resources, and you achieve an outcome together. And I'm in class and I'm going, just remember, everybody, you can't talk during this. You have to just work independently by yourself. And it's a real challenge to kind of marry up what's happening further down the school with what's got to happen for assessment purposes further up the school. So you've got to be aware of that wave that's going to come of people who, you know, got through the transition, but then there's going to be people who, for whom that transition is no longer a transition, that it's, you know, they're people who have expectations, they have a view of the way the world works, and what's the pressure of that going to be in the future.
So we you know, have our younger kids, and we're teaching them to share and to be friendly and to work together on things. Then when they get older and they have to go through testing and no sharing, no talking, and then they get out in the workplace and you have to work well with others.
That's the way it is at the moment, I'm afraid.
I mean, Literally, so it's like the things that I want my 3-year-old to do, he won't be able to do in school when he's 15. And, you know, Apple made some changes to their certification program earlier, in the middle of last year. And they basically removed the proctored exams. And now the exams are structured in a way where it's not asking you, okay, tell me what is wrong here. Like if you have, you know, it used to say like, okay, you got this issue, tell me what's wrong. So you kind of need to memorize various things about the computers. And now the exams are set up to, where do you find this in GSX, which is Apple's online backend parts system? Or assuming you have this issue, what would be your next steps be? And it's, you basically, two of the answers might work, but you have to go find in the support manuals what their next recommendation is. And so they're asking you to show me that you know how to find out what to do. And as I mentioned earlier, that is life. That is the sharing and the collaboration and the access to the internet. That is life. I mean, when would you ask, you know, someone at your office, okay, you can't work with anybody on this, you can't ask for help, and you can't research it? That is just not the real world today. So I don't understand why your education system hasn't moved past that. I know that's a larger discussion, but it just kind of seems ironic or kind of frustrating that we teach our kids to do when they're younger what they can't do when they're in school, and then we expect them to reverse it when they're in their workplace.
This is the challenge, and I think as part of the vision and part of the leadership, you have to be alive to the realization that there's some of those things that you can change and there's some of those things you absolutely can't. And what are you going to do when the two things hit together and you maybe can't necessarily change something? You've got to adapt your, you know, perfect, beautiful vision of computer use in school to the slightly harsh realities of the way that external organizations want to put those boundaries in place for what you can and can't do. That's something that you're going to have to be aware of, and you're going to have to manage that transition and lead through it as well. What I want to do, Brad, is I want to just roll back to that stages of grief kind of model. I want to talk a little bit. A version of it has been presented to me from time to time of change in an organization, so organizational change, rather than necessarily like those specific steps about grief and loss and so on. But they're kind of based on the same thing. And in this model, the first phase that you might see is essentially shock and denial, right? That I can't believe we're doing this. I can't believe we're going iPad, you know, and we're going to make sure this never works here, okay? And I think the key thing here is, what's the leadership response going to be for that? Now, whether you are the formal leader of the school or whether you have been put in a leadership position to manage that transition, what are you going to do about that when people are saying it's never going to work, and they're shocked about it and they're upset about it? What are you going to do as a leader in there? I'll give you a couple of suggestions. Number one, clear information. Okay, you have to have worked out in your head, and probably worked out on paper, because you're going to send emails and you're going to communicate to parents, what it is you're trying to do. Is it actually that we are going one-to-one iPad starting in August? Or is it that we are trialing these things with a view to, in a certain other date, doing something? And I'm mentioning dates specifically because the next thing you want to do is you want to give clear timetables and specific details of what is to happen and when. So it's critical as a leader that you have worked out what all these things are. Again, a mixture of schools I've been to, but situations where we say things like, here's a bunch of iPads, anybody who's interested can get one, and we'll use them for a while, and then, you know, come back and let us know what you think, and maybe we'll think about a program after that. That's not leadership, right? That is just dipping your toe in the water and seeing what happens.
And where else would we do that in an organization? It's like, all right, guys, we're going to put in these new personnel policies that you have to send us an email with what you did throughout the week. And if you want to do that, that's great. And if you don't, that's fine too.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's just going to do what they were already doing. And if you're a sales manager and you have this new sales technique, and you know it'll be great, you're going to have to force your salespeople to do it. Otherwise, they'll just keep doing what they always wanted to do. Unless you have the overachiever that is always trying new things. But if you have a vision as a leader, you have to push that through and to let people know it's the expectation, not an optional thing.
Yep, definitely. So in response to your people's shock and denial, as a leader, you want to provide clear information, you want to provide a timetable, and you want to provide specifics about what the vision is. Don't just say, you know, maybe if you don't have a vision, maybe pause at this point and start to figure out what the vision is before you try and communicate it to people. Next step, people are going to feel anxiety. They may feel resentment, and they may even display some anger. And in a leadership role, one of the key things here is you've got to let people be heard. Because if you don't, if you just say, well, blinkers are on, we're just going to do this, and anybody who says anything else is just wrong, and they're outside the team, and only people who like it are inside the team, and we're just going to go for it. And, you know, doubters be damned, we're going to go for it. What you end up with there is you're going to end up with people who just feel completely disengaged from the whole process because they haven't been heard. They may have actual valid concerns that you probably haven't thought of. Or maybe you have thought of them and you've discounted them, and maybe you shouldn't have discounted them. But you've got to provide opportunities for people to be heard. And even if you're not going to actually act on what they say, it's important for them to know that they've been heard as well. So meetings, opportunities for discussion, focus groups, all that kind of stuff can really help that kind of situation.
Yeah, I think the more you listen, even without, again, like you said, changing, I think that's very helpful, because nothing is more frustrating than changes being made that you know will affect you and then no one wants to hear you. Even if the changes are for the good, it's still nice as an employee to be heard.
Yes, and in some ways, as with many kind of forms of consultation, the reason for consultation is not for the effect it has on the result as much as for the effect it has on the people upon whom the result will fall. And one of the key things to do there is keep going with your messaging about why this change is going to happen. Okay, so we're doing this because we've got to make school look more like the real world. We're doing this to improve literacy and numeracy, or whatever your message is. Reiterate those messages. And then the third thing is, at that point, there's going to be a lot of misconceptions, a lot of gossip, a lot of whispers, a lot of rumor about what's being planned. And I think one of the reasons for discussion is to get all of those misconceptions out into the open and address them head on. You know, people might feel, you know, if you are going one-to-one, people might feel, oh, we're never going to use paper again, what are we going to do? And you can address that. If that's not part of your vision, just say that's not part of the deal. We're not trying that, okay? If we get there, we get there. If we don't, we don't. But that's not part of the vision. So that's, you know, the first couple of phases: shock and denial, anxiety, resentment, anger, all of these feelings. And then you may fall into a sort of period of apathy. And the key thing for a leader at that point is support and encouragement. Okay, now whether you can do that personally or whether you have to do that through a group situation or through delegation to other people, but making sure that people who are trying but are maybe not succeeding that well or need some more help, that they A, get the help, but B, an opportunity to show what you've done. And a way that I've seen this done really effectively is to have informal after-school meetings just for people to share what they're doing. That's a very, very effective strategy in the early days of a deployment, is once people have started trying things, in a very non-judgmental and non-confrontational environment, just providing an opportunity for people, possibly even without the involvement of the leaders or the management in particular, giving them an opportunity just to show what each other has done. And maybe it's not the best thing ever, maybe it's not that impressive, but just to show that things are being done and getting feedback from other people. The bigger the school, the more important that is. Little schools can do it quite easily. Big schools tend to have to formalize that process. But if you do, and you make it a thing that people come to, and make it safe to do so, then it can be incredibly effective at the beginning of a deployment.
I always joke that small schools are like a speedboat, where you can kind of change visions quickly if something new comes along that you know is great. Yep. But the bigger schools are more like a cruise ship, and it takes time because there's a process and there's a lot more players involved and generally a lot more money involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's key. That's one of the situations where it's very school specific, exactly what would be the best thing to do there. And you have to use your judgment and your prior experience in your school to decide what's the best thing to do here. But a couple of models that have been tried, you know, lunchtime meetups, 5 minutes, show us your favorite app this week or whatever, or give us examples of pupil work that blew you away, something like that. Simple, cheap, not expensive in terms of money or time, but increase the collaboration across the school is very, very important. You'll eventually get to a stage where people accept and start experimenting, right? And as a leader, what are you going to do there? Well, again, that communication aspect. Once people are experimenting, get them to share. Make sure that people have a way to think about how to go from I've started doing a couple of things with iPads to I'm ready to take the next step in my teaching or my practice in the classroom. And again, always with the message and the vision. I want to talk in a wee minute, Bradley, just about how you might give people those next steps, because there's a couple of really useful frameworks for that. And eventually, if you succeed with all of the above, if you get to the final boss level, if you like, you'll get people to engage. It will become the thing that your school does. We become an iPad school or a Chromebook school or whatever it is. And at that point, people have been working at a very tactical level for a long time. And the key thing for the sustainability of your deployment is to get people to move from the day-to-day tactics of what am I going to do with the iPad today and how do I do that, to what's my long-term goal for changing the teaching of computer science in a world where everybody's got an iPad in their hands, let's say. And that's a change that has to happen over, you know, that's your 5 to 8 year horizon, Bradley, is that strategic change that's going to happen. Once people have accepted that the change has happened, that it's not going to go back, the change is irrevocable, and we're now doing this thing, how do you start to get them to almost sort of go back to being teachers, if that makes sense, and start to think about, well, how does this fit into my development planning over years and years and years, with the assumption now that we've got these devices in place? I'll give you a concrete example from Cedars. Sorry, Bradley, do you want to come in on that first?
Well, I was just going to say that over a few years, HR turnover changes a lot of this too. Because if you have people that see this as the future, but that's just not the future for them, they often leave. And not that we're trying to push people out the door, but if you've got a vision that's been set by a leader and you know the key players are on board, you kind of have to either get on that vision or get out. And so, and then the people that are coming in to replace, that's the only vision they've ever known.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, the example I was going to give from our experience, Bradley, was that we started doing our iPad stuff in 2010, and then our secondary teachers had been sort of looking at and are now starting to implement new exam curriculum in Scotland. And of course, there's got to be development work that goes around that. And one of the ways I wanted to try and move people from being, you know, tactical to being strategic is to start thinking, to say to them, look, when you start looking at National 5 and the new hires, I want you to think about what you're going to do with the assumption that everybody's going to have an iPad in their hands, right? So don't just design your course the way you'd always designed it around pen and paper. Start to design it based on iPad. And that's where when you start to get some of these little mismatches between the expectations of externally set curriculum and the things that you might want to do internally. And that's a strategic thing that you have to manage. And we are managing it, but there are certainly some bumps along the road. So again, that's a leadership thing. You've got to smooth out those bumps for people as much as possible. So, time's moving on, Bradley. This is turning into a long show, but we're getting towards the end of it. Last thing I wanted to do, I don't know if you've used much of these in your school, Bradley, but I'm a big fan of what you might call conceptual frameworks for thinking about technology in school. Have you used much of these?
No.
Okay. One of the things that can happen, I've seen it happen several times in schools, where leadership are talking about a big, big transition, say going from being a school with two computer labs to being a one-to-one iPad school. That's a dramatic step change in the way that people work with computers in school. One of the problems with a big and bold vision is that it can seem overwhelming to a lot of people. And it can be very hard to conceptualize how you as a person would go from this world that you know to this world that is to come, which is this one-to-one Wi-Fi enabled free internet access world. And one of the things that I find very useful is to give teachers frameworks for thinking about their progress from where they are to where you want them to be. There's two frameworks I want to mention briefly. There's not really time in the scope of this show to talk about each of them in detail, but so people are aware of them, we'll put links in the notes as well to find more about these. But there's one, if you've been to any Apple events around about education, you'll have heard of this one called SAMR, S-A-M-R. And it comes out of the research that was done around about the state of Maine and the Maine Learning Technology Initiative, which, if you remember, was their program to put out, I think, 50,000 iBooks, as was, iBook G4 laptops, in a one-to-one program, big program. And I'm thinking, I can't remember exactly how long ago that was now. It must have been like 2004, maybe 2005, something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking 04.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty well-established program now. And, of course, there was the fuss, you know, last year when the new governor of the state came in and there was a decision that the contract was going to go to, I think, HP instead of Apple. But whatever. I have no dog in that fight either way. But the point was that my understanding of where SAMR came from was that they gave all the schools in Maine the same kind of technology, same computer, same kind of level of access. But what they realized was that some schools were kind of making what you might call just incremental progress on this, and other schools were making, you know, skyrocketing exponential progress. And the question arose, well, why are some schools doing one thing and some schools not achieving the same result? Now, if anybody listening is actually from Maine, they can, you know, write into the show and correct me on the backstory to this. But they brought in a researcher, a guy by the name of Ruben Puntadura, and we'll link to his website in the show notes as well, to go and have a look at these schools and see why were some schools doing apparently better than others with given the same kind of investment in technology. And what he came up with was he identified that the skyrocketing schools were doing a thing that he called transformation. And the schools that weren't taking off at that rate were doing something that he called sort of sustaining modifications to their technology. And so he came up with this model called SAMR, and it's an acronym, S-A-M-R. S stands for substitution, A stands for augmentation, M stands for modification, and R stands for redefinition. And these are notionally four levels of progress you can make in technology adoption. I'll just briefly state what each of them stands for. Substitution, the first step of bringing technology into a classroom, basically says that your technology acts as a direct tool substitute with no real functional change. So a good example of that, Bradley, is when we do digital exams, what we have there is we get a PDF of the exact same exam paper as is on paper, but with the space for writing filled in with a PDF form. And we have to turn off the spell checking, and we have to turn off the grammar checking and all that stuff. And essentially the pupils get to type on the exam paper. So that's a direct substitution of a computer for a written paper and zero functional change because we have to turn off all the additional supports.
So it's like version 2 of the pen.
Pretty much, yeah. It's a typewriter instead of a pen, basically. But then the next level up is augmentation, where you can take your technology, turn it into a substitute for an analog tool, and get some kind of functional improvement. So you might say that if we left the spell checking on and the grammar checking on, then that's essentially substituting, but with some functional improvements in that we can have the computer help us out a little bit, autocorrect, and so on. Although it's a debatable thing whether autocorrect is actually a help or not. But those two are notionally below this line of transformation, if you like, where substitution and augmentation are good starting points. Don't get me wrong, this isn't a grading scale, but it's important to realize that substitution and augmentation are first steps, and there are steps you can go beyond that. So the modification step is where technology allows for significant redesign of the task that you're going to do. So you might say, for example, instead of just writing an essay, we're going to write a report. We're going to put in, you know, do sort of desktop publishing kind of task where there's pictures and graphs and charts and they're all in together. Whereas you wouldn't really do that on paper. Okay, you might draw a chart or whatever and might draw a picture beside it, but it's not the same kind of thing as doing it with fonts and color and all that kind of stuff. So that's redesign of the task. And then redefinition is where the technology allows for the creation of new tasks previously inconceivable. So instead of perhaps writing an essay or doing desktop publishing, what we'll do is we'll in fact shoot it as a video and post it on the web. You know, that could be our science report, for example. That's a task that's previously inconceivable, whether because of equipment constraints, you didn't have enough cameras before, or the software was too complicated, or it just wasn't something you had access to before. There's many different reasons why it might have been inconceivable, but that redefinition step at the top is, you know, the last step you can take in the transformation of technology, or the transformation of your school through the adoption of technology. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. I think it's just, I've always loved that model because it's an easy way to take people through kind of your ultimate goal. And in a way that especially folks in education can understand.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of things that SAMR does for you. If you're a school who's looking at going one to an iPad, and you were to come and visit my school, which anybody is welcome to do, so please send me an email. But if you come to my school and all you've ever known is a Windows XP box that was managed by someone else, it can sometimes be a little bit overwhelming for somebody to come to a very well-established one-to-one program and try and extract lessons from that apply to their current situation. And this is one time where I would use SAMR with, say, visitors to the school. I'd say, look, what you're seeing here is the end of nearly 4 years of learning about how to use this in the classroom. You're not going to take this lesson that we've done home and do it tomorrow with your one iPad. But you could do it in a couple of years' time once you've had all the practice that we've had. But here's the steps that you can go through, and here's how you can get started. And one of the beauties of SAMR is it gives people a really good way to get started. So let's just do a substitution step. Let's do a physics experiment where instead of using a stopwatch, we just time it with the stopwatch on the iPad. It's a direct substitution step, but it's a step to get started. And then think about how we can move on from there. How can we move on from there? How can we move on from there? And that's the power of a conceptual framework, is it gives people scope, and it avoids the concept that, oh, we've just got to change everything right away. No, here's the steps you go through: substitution, augmentation, and so on. They also provide people with a way to think about a world that they maybe don't understand, so they don't have even the words for it. And a framework can also provide that language, so we can talk about substitution and augmentation and give us new words that everybody understands, so that we can then start to have conversations about what's happening in our classrooms. Because if we don't have the words for it, it's very hard to get across our experience to someone else. And frameworks really provide the language for that. I love frameworks. I'm a very theoretical kind of person. Not everybody is. People just want to sometimes get in there and get their hands dirty, but I like to give people a framework to think about it first.
One of the best things, I think I love frameworks, you know, based on your discussions of it, is it's easy to visualize it, and you can put it on a chart, put it on a screen, and you can take people step by step. Because I found teachers like to know the path they're going. It's like, okay, we're going to start with this, we're going to move to this, we're going to move to that, and then move to that, and here's our ultimate goal. Instead of just starting and saying, okay, here's our goal, we're moving towards it. But you walk them through that process, and especially with SAMR.
Yep. SAMR is really powerful. There's another one that's commonly used. It's called TPAC, and the acronym stands for Technology, Pedagogy, and Content Knowledge. And the idea with this one's a wee bit more kind of high level, but the point that it makes, and I wish I didn't know about this framework when I started doing iPad deployment at our school, and I wish I had, because it would have saved me a lot of independent thinking about it. But what they're saying is that you can know about technology, you can know about pedagogy, and you can know about content. And different teachers at different points in the school combine often two of the three of those together. So you might know technology and pedagogy, and you might be what could be called a tech coordinator or something like that in your school, where you know how to teach, you know about technology, you know how to put the two things together. Or if you're a subject teacher specialist, like a computing teacher or maths teacher, you know the content, you know the pedagogy, you know how to teach maths. But maybe you never use technology. And if you're a technology expert who knows also about content, maybe you're a school librarian. But then what would it be if you put all of those things together? Somebody who knew about technology and pedagogy and content and made them the teacher. That could be potentially incredibly powerful. And that's essentially what the TPAC model argues, is that when you put all those three things together, you get a powerful result. I haven't used that one so much with our teachers or with other teachers, but it's a good one to have in the back of your mind as you're looking at what's going on if you go into a school situation. You know, who's the technology expert here? Who's the pedagogy expert? Who's the content expert? Who's responsible for all of those things? And trying to bring those people together, maybe bring them onto the project team. That may be the right thing to do in that situation. And TPAC's another very useful one. And I know they're currently working on some updates to that model as well. So TPAC.org is a website for that one too.
And we'll have a link, link to some information about TPAC and SAMR in the show notes at outofschool.net.
Yep. For SAMR, there's no canonical reference book for SAMR, but there is a series of lectures on iTunes U called As We May Teach, which is very, very useful. That's essentially what, until every time I meet him, which is, you know, once every couple of years, I try and bug Ruben to write a book about it. But so far, what we've got is this iTunes U course that he's put together, and it's kind of the canonical reference right now for the idea of SAMR. But it's such a lightweight model that I think even just with my description of it here and Googling it up on the web, people should be able to at least get started with SAMR.
But isn't the iTunes U course really part of SAMR as it's a redefinition?
Hmm.
It's like he's already done the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, some of those things, if you wanted to listen to a whole iTunes U course, you know, it's like a book, but it's, you know, you may be able to read a book faster. So not every redefinition is an improvement. Sometimes you've got to be judicious about it as well. And I think if there's one thing I want to just finish on with SAMR, it's I want to make a point that it's really, really, really important that you don't use SAMR as a way to grade your teachers, because that will just produce fear and resentment of another kind. SAMR is not, it's the aim is not always to be redefining everything that you do, because you can't do that. Like, nobody can work at that level all the time. But what you can do is you can aim for it, and if you fall short, you've done something else. But also, there are some tasks where the win for bringing technology into the classroom is just the substitution step or the augmentation step or the bit that just saves you a bit of time in class every day. That can be a win too. But do be aware that there'll be some people who will say, well, my subject only ever needs to be augmented. My subject can't be redefined. And in fact, that's a wee bit of a red flag as well in your conversation, is that the people who never do anything that's transformational, you're going to want to have a look at what they're doing and maybe get them some support from other teachers who have done on occasion things that are transformational as well.
It's kind of like I heard this old saying once, a leader, you've got, you know, only so many dollars to use with change. And you see, you want to start out spending quarters with people. As they see what you're doing is good, you can move it up to 75 cents and you can start playing your dollars, but you don't spend those dollars all at once. You do them slowly.
Yeah, and you've got to spend them wisely as well. But I think one of the things that can be very, very powerful in this is pairing people together. So somebody who's confident, somebody who's not so confident, buddy them up. You know, you can go a long way just doing that kind of thing as well.
Going back to that whole collaboration thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't put all your teachers in a classroom, have them do a written test on how to teach with the iPad, and then they can just go out and do it, right? We should probably stop talking about this before I get into trouble.
Yes, I don't think anybody from my school listens, so that'll be good.
Okay. I don't know if anybody from my school listens either. I've never asked. I'm not going to ask either.
It's like you'd either be terrified to know that they do or sad to know that they don't.
Yeah.
So it's just better to...
But I do know other people listen. Hi, everybody. Yeah, we have quite the reach, actually. When I was at that event in London, a few people came up to me and said, you know, love the podcast. You know, people don't say they love my blog anymore, they love the podcast. So you can take all the credit for that, Bradley.
Well, you know, it is what it is.
It is. Okay, so why don't we wrap up this show? We've talked about vision, we've talked about leadership, we've talked about some conceptual frameworks that you can give to people to help them through that change process, give them actual concrete steps and new language to help them understand where it is they're going. We've talked about the sustainability of the vision, the timescale, the messaging, the way that you're going to bring people on board, making sure they're heard, giving them opportunities to share their practice and their experience and their learning, and then eventually getting them to move from that tactical day-to-day survival mode into a much more strategic mode and planning for the long term based on what it is they've got, what they've achieved already with your new technology deployment.
And all the links we talked about today, along with a link to our sponsor, Phraseology, will be in the show notes in your, either your podcast app or at outofschool.net. So we would appreciate you heading over to our site, sending us some feedback, and patronizing our sponsors.
Yeah. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for joining us on this trip. We're looking forward to doing the rest of these shows, and we really look forward to your feedback on all of those as well. So you can find me on the web at spears.org and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
And I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers and on the web at chambersdaily.com.
Okay, so until next time, thanks for listening.